Dr. John Witherspoon, who was looked to by a lot of people in the 18th century for advice about how to rear their children, gave, among other things, advice about how to keep an 8-month-old child under control of his parents. And he said the important thing is to take something away from the child at least once a day. In the same century, the 18th century, a man named Josiah Quincy tells the story of having been taken every morning of his childhood into the basement of his Boston home and having been plunged into a vat of cold spring water because his parents had been reading the British philosopher John Locke. And Locke believed that cold water grows strong children, and that besides, if a child is not exposed to weather, when he gets his feet wet occasionally, he just might take cold, become ill. So his answer was frequent wetting of the feet with cold water. Or in the 19th century, Aaron Burr said to his daughter, a teenager, "Your vile habit of bad posture is bound to bring TB. Or in the same century, a school teacher had the philosophy that the only way to handle incoming children who are there in the class for the first time is to beat them until they become ill or vomit. And after that time, they'll be in subjection to the teacher." In the late 1920s, a behavioral psychologist in America, John Watson, was trying to advise parents about how to rear children, and he insisted that heredity has very little importance. The real thing is conditioning the child to do what you want him to do, somewhat in the mold of Pavlov's dog responding to a stimulus. And he suggested, among other things, that parents never let the children sit on their laps, never kiss them, but keep an aloofness from them, a kind of cold formality. All of those are stories told in a recent book called The Little Darlings by Mary Cable, The History of Child Rearing in America. But it's an interesting thing to know something of how, through the centuries in this country, parents have gone about the task of rearing children. And to know that as we rear them, we're not the first ones to struggle with the problems we have, but ours are very similar to preceding generations, and the strangest sort of advice has been given at one time or another. To change the tone just a bit, but to point up the seriousness of what we're talking about this morning, a little over a year ago, the Jewish League of Greater New York City published a full-page ad in the New York Times. And the ad said in large, bold type, "If you are Jewish, chances are your children won't be." It was a reminder that an awful lot of young people are growing up without any sense of their identity, especially their religious identity, and that they're not going to share the religious convictions of their parents. All of this reminds me a great deal of several biblical passages where there's an emphasis on passing the truth on from one generation to another. In Matthew 3, verse 9, John the Baptist had come to do his forerunning work for Jesus. And when the Pharisees and Sadducees came out to him, he said, "Do not think to say to yourselves, 'We have Abraham as our father.' I tell you that God is able of these stones to raise up children to Abraham." To translate that into modern language, John the Baptist was saying, "Don't tell me your father was an elder, and your grandfather was a preacher, and your brother is the treasurer, and your uncle was a deacon. I want to know what you are doing in the cause of Christ, what your convictions are." Jesus was always consistent in emphasizing that. To a Nicodemus, though he was ruler among the Jews, he would say, "Except you be born again, you can't see the kingdom of God." To Simon Peter and the rest of the disciples, "Who do men say I am?" But then comes the crucial question, "Who do you say I am?" In Matthew 28, as he gave the Great Commission, it was, "Go teach all nations, baptizing them into the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, and then teach them to observe all things I've commanded you. For lo, I'm with you always, even to the end of the world." If you notice the text this morning in 2 Timothy 1, it's Paul's concern over the same issue. Paul remembers that he had believed God, and he was praying to the God in whom he believed since his fathers. In fact, it was the God in whom his fathers had also believed. He recalled his own heritage in the Jewish faith, where he'd first learned of Jehovah God, and now he's become a Christian. And then he calls to mind Timothy and gives thanks to God for him. And not just for Timothy, but for the fact that a woman told her daughter, and the daughter told her son, and from Lois to Eunice to Timothy, has come the teaching about the true God. The faith has been passed along from generation to generation. Today was promotion day in our Bible classes. It's the day when we remind ourselves annually in a special way we're engaged in a task of teaching our children, of passing on something that someone has earlier passed on to us. And today that has with it a good many serious implications. In Joshua 4th chapter, when the Israelites had come across the Jordan River into the Promised Land, Joshua had each tribe choose a man, and out of that selection, 12 men would pick up 12 stones, and they carried them over to a place called Gilgal, and there they set them up in a monument. Joshua may seem to be almost wasting time. There are wells to be dug, there are tents to be set up, there are vineyards to be planted, there are crops to be put out and tended, there are enemies to be faced, there are decisions to be made, disputes to be worked out. Almost anything you can name in society today, Joshua had to deal with among the Israelites. And there he is setting up a monument of 12 stones. But Joshua knew, and God was through him placing importance upon, the fact that memory plays an important role in our lives. And it shapes us for all those other tasks we are called on to do. Christianity, the Old Testament before it, place a great deal of emphasis on memory, on history and what God has done in history. Aeschylus is the oldest of the Greek playwrights from whom we have any extant plays today. And out of some 80 that he wrote, we have about 7. But 3 of them are a trilogy which tells the story of the legendary king Agamemnon when he came back from Troy, and a great deal of bloodshed and violence which surrounded this. And Aeschylus works with this and offers a theory about the way Zeus suffers when men suffer. The way Zeus has suffered, and this is being acted out in men's own lives. A suffering of the gods. Many a religion had its mythical story of some suffering of the god in the past, which had made something possible for human beings. But Christianity is different. It begins, and when Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea in the days of Herod the king, Matthew 2 verse 1. Or as Luke puts it in chapter 2 verse 1, Caesar had given a decree that all the world should be enrolled. A little bit about the tax situation, the Roman Empire in the first century. It was the day when Quirinius was governor of Syria. Or when Jesus is about to be crucified, the gospel writers tell us it was in the days of Pontius Pilate, procurator of Judea. It's sort of like saying in the days when Henry Kissinger was Secretary of State, or in the days when Dwight Eisenhower was President of the United States, or whatever. There is a historical date driven down. Something happened. It wasn't invented. It occurred. And men were willing to die for their faith that they had seen the evidence of it having occurred. He died on a cross, was buried in a tomb, raised up, and one by one his followers, the leaders, were systematically eliminated because they wouldn't recant that faith. Something happened. There's something in history to which we can anchor. And what Paul is saying in this text is that this kind of story has to be passed on to other people. What you've heard among me and among many witnesses, commit to faithful men who'll be able to teach others also. We have a lot of great causes in our time. We live in a very disturbed and disturbing world. And it's easy for any individual aware of hunger, maybe as many as 12,000 people a day starving to death, inflation, more than 8% of the people in our nation out of work, the Middle East sitting like a time bomb, cooled for a day or two or a month or two or a year or two at a time, the specter of nuclear warfare if there should be a misunderstanding between powers or someone who becomes greedy enough to make the test. It's easy in a world like that to cast oneself into a good many causes and to almost get absorbed by those causes. To be so busy in good causes that we forget the work at home that's very important too. Transmitting the faith that has been transmitted to us. Handing on what we have been taught so the next generation will believe it and know why it believes it as well. Paul believed in Christian nurture, in telling the children. He knew, as John the Baptist was putting it, that God does not have any grandchildren. that every generation has to believe for itself and has to be brought into obedience for itself. Paul didn't claim Timothy in this letter. He gave the credit to Lois and Eunice. You know how itinerant evangelists sometimes are today. We sort of polish the trophies and tell about the persons who've been baptized and display the results of the efforts. Paul traveled. He did the work. He saw the results, but he didn't handle it that way. Paul came into Lystra one day, which was sort of a backwater town in Asia Minor, and met a cripple and healed a cripple. And the people in the city knew about the cripple, and now they saw him well. And they decided that Paul and his helper Barnabas just had to be two of the gods. It must be that Barnabas is Zeus and Paul is Mercurius or Jupiter, because he has the responsibility of, or Hermes, not Jupiter, he has the responsibility of explaining to other people what Zeus has on his mind. So Barnabas is the greatest of the gods, but Paul's the talker. He's going to tell us about the gods. So they rushed them into the village square, brought their bull in, were going to offer a sacrifice, and then they wanted Paul and Barnabas to share something with them. Paul stopped the sacrifice. It was difficult for him to do. And then he preached to the people about the true God. But it wasn't very long until some enemies of his over in the other towns began coming into Lystra, just hounding him. And when they found that Paul was there and he was having influence, they stirred up the people against him. And that fickle bunch stoned Paul outside the city and left him for dead. All that happened in the town called Lystra on Paul's first missionary journey. When Paul went through there 2 or 3 years later on his second missionary journey, he chose a young man named Timothy to go with him on his preaching tour, to be a companion for much of the rest of his life. It would have been easy enough for Paul to look back and say, Timothy, you remember the time when I was stoned to death. You remember that cripple who was healed and that sermon that was preached. And what an impact these had on your life. Now I want you to pass it on to somebody else. None of that. Paul said, when I recall the faith of your grandmother and your mother and the faith that I know is in you too, that's what I give thanks to God for. He believed in Christian nurture. Well, all of this suggests to me that you and I have a responsibility for Christian nurture too. That is, helping a person grow up. We have an evangelistic responsibility, to be sure, a benevolent responsibility. But nothing is more crucial, if anything is as crucial, as being able to train up people who can continue to carry the load of teaching other people. Who is going to tell the children? You know, they don't learn automatically. It isn't enough just to fight the wolves. You've got to feed the sheep. When the sheep look up, if they aren't given food, they're going to crop off any noxious weed they can find. Somebody has to take the responsibility of telling the children, of teaching them. And that's the church's special responsibility. Paul knew this, and he was underlining it so the church could become aware of it. The church has that special responsibility of passing along the doctrine, the teaching that has come from God. When Dorothy Sayers wrote a little book a few years ago called Creed or Chaos, she was struggling with a time when people don't want to hear doctrines. When they're just convinced that the reason church buildings are empty is that preachers are so full of dull doctrines. And when people go in, they hear these doctrines, they know there's some controversy about them, they don't know why they should believe them, so they go away and give up. It has no relevance to life. She came out with the opposite conclusion. She said the reason church buildings are empty is that not enough doctrine has been preached. Not enough an investigation has been made of the Scripture to know what true doctrine is and to pass it on from one generation to another. She said, I believe if you should give a quiz to an average church member on the basics of the Christian faith, if you should ask him, for example, what or who is the Trinity? Then she made a play on a creed called the Athanasian Creed from the 5th century, and she said the answer would probably be, well, it's God the Father incomprehensible, and the Son incomprehensible, and the Holy Spirit incomprehensible, and the whole thing incomprehensible. Well, the creed had said the first part, but she concluded the rest. Or she said a person would probably respond, well, it's something the theologians invented to make everything a little more difficult, but it has no real relationship to daily life. But there is a responsibility of teaching, and the church has the responsibility of making that doctrine understandable and related to daily life. We have an awful lot of Bible school teachers at Highland Street. Some have been in the classroom for a number of years with very little recognition. They work quietly behind the scenes, but they're busy telling the children, telling the adults. You know, we have a lot of other questions. our attitude toward the faith is we want to analyze it a little more. Want to define it a little further. Maybe we can express it to somebody else. Read another book about it. Hide and seek. Play a little game of hide and seek with it. Go away from it for a while. Come back to it. Not too sure today. Very sure tomorrow. But while we're trying to make up our minds and read our next book, God is trying to raise up a new congregation every 25 years. He has to if this work is going on. There has to be a new body virtually every 25 years. I'm not playing down the importance of study or the importance of seeking answers to unresolved questions, but I am emphasizing the importance of passing along what one is sure of. If one is hoping to find a place where he'll know everything about the subject before he communicates any of the subject, shouldn't tell his child anything about diet or health care or a number of other subjects as well as religion. But we treat nothing else like that. And Christianity has to be passed on with the understanding of it we have and with a continual attempt to learn more about it. Because the church has a responsibility, but it's a responsibility in conjunction with the home. The home has the responsibility as well. It's easy enough for us to farm out our children, let them learn everything they need to know somewhere else. They can learn to be literate at school. They can learn how to play athletics under the coach. They can learn how to survive in hard circumstances in the scouting troop. But everything can be picked up somewhere. But what we may forget is that the home is the hub of all that activity, the place from which they're sent and to which they return, and it has a character of its own that it's implanting on them. I really doubt if the finest Sunday school in the world can overcome the neglect of an indifferent home. A home that doesn't care or doesn't try to impart the teachings of Christ. The two supplement each other. Oh, it's hard. We all know that. We figure that in modern cities it must be harder than it's ever been. I'm not sure of that. How would it have been to live in Lystra, where Lois and Eunice lived, and where they tried to bring up young Timothy? There was not, so far as we can tell, even a Jewish synagogue in that town. There was a great big pagan temple. It must have been difficult to bring up a child to know about the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob with that kind of surroundings. But they did it because they realized that they had to tell the children. They had to pass on the teaching. Why do the children have to be told? Psychologists occasionally talk about the pampered, neglected child. That seems to be a contradiction in terms. But they mean to imply by it that the child's always pampered in that his needs are always anticipated before he has them or is aware of them. And neglected because she's never allowed to create an ego of her own. Something is always provided for her before she scarcely needs it. The pattern is the mother says, "I'm hungry, you eat all of your supper." Or, "I'm cold, you'd better get warm. Anything I feel, the child has to feel as well." Or, "I'm afraid, so you'd better be religious. You'd better go to church with me." It isn't that kind of thing that needs to be passed on. The why is much deeper than that. The why is that there's a body of truth which God has revealed to men in history, which gives an anchoring point, a central purpose, and a meaning to life and eternity. Your family has some shorthand it uses all the time. Some code words. I don't know what those code words are, and I'm not really going to burden you by telling you what ours are. But the kind of thing I'm talking about is, all you have to do is just say, "You remember that old 1958 Edsel?" And everybody around the table remembers. They remember when the thing broke down. They remember taking trips on it, in it. They remember just a lot of ways it fitted into life. Or you say, "You remember the cabin?" And you point out the place where it was, and that just stands for all sorts of things. And everybody begins to gather together ideas that are associated with that cabin, the vacation they took there, the things that occurred that weren't expected to happen there. Or about all you have to say is, "Do you remember?" And you name a certain relative, and he has characteristics that just bubble over on everybody who's present. Or the very serious family says, "You remember the way grandmother passed away?" And that just brings back to everybody a good bit of the kind of serenity that marked an occasion that they want to emulate and imitate when their own time comes. Shorthand, code words, gestures, that just have all kinds of hidden meanings for a family. The Christian family's like that. That's part of what the teaching process is all about. You won't remember the two or the three or the 6 points that I'm trying to make this morning in detail a year from now. I know that. I probably wouldn't be able to write you a careful outline of them myself that long later. You won't remember in detail everything the Bible school teachers have said on a given Sunday morning. But in the midst of all this, we begin to absorb some code words, some shorthand. There are some places, some objects, some characters, some moods that get plowed into the fiber of our existence. Objects like Noah's Ark and Solomon's Temple and Jacob's Ladder and Pilate's wash basin and Jesus' cross and Elijah's mantle. And one just thinks of object after object, Job's ash pit, that just begin to suggest countless helps for life in a given situation. Or there's a kind of geography of the soul that gets embedded. The River Jordan, the Garden of Eden, the Brook Kebar, the Damascus Road, the Road to Emmaus, the Jericho Road, the Way of the Cross. And with this kind of geography, we have a subconscious nature working that puts us right back in those places in a given challenge in life. Or there are characters, and we begin to remember the courage of an Elijah, the patience of a Job, the meekness of a Moses. Or there are moods of people in the Bible. David dancing before that ark, so happy to see that ark back in Jerusalem. Solomon humbly praying at the dedication of that temple. Jeremiah, Isaiah, Amos, all reluctant to be prophets, and yet God has called them to take a mission they feel inadequate for. Jonah, indignant, angry, not going to preach to those people. Peter, cocksure, I'll never deny you, no matter what else happens. But one by one, we recall those moods, and they get plowed into the framework of our lives. That's what it's about. Each one of the sermons, each one of the Bible class lessons plows a bit more of that fiber into our hearts and makes it more part of our lives. And when our children say, what do these stones mean? We begin telling them what the stones mean. This has a great deal to say, not just on promotion day for Bible school, but about every week's task and the way the church and the home cooperate. To the older, it has a way of saying what Donald Michael recently said. He's counted to be one of the most astute students of the cross currents of our times, one of the best predictors of what ought to happen tomorrow if the world keeps going. And Michael deals in his book, The Next Generation, with your children. He says a lot of things, but the impressive thing is your children are going to grow up to be a lot like you. That's the main thing. If you've been looking at young people and worrying about the future of the world, I'd suggest a different view. Start looking at the adults and worrying about the future of the world. The older people have a responsibility to communicate the faith, but the younger people have a responsibility too. Sometimes we don't want to be taught. We'd rather find our own way. We fancy that we may be a bit wiser, a bit sharper than somebody who's been taken in by this or that. Everybody is in the patient-doctor relationship once in a while. The patient has the pain, and the doctor listens to the symptoms, and he isn't suffering at all. But if the patient describes the various things he feels, it isn't very long until the doctor knows more about the disease than the patient does. And the same kind of thing prevails between generations. The younger person may be the one who has the problem, but if it can just be explored and discussed, sometimes the older person knows more about it than the person who really has it. What I'm talking about today is not just an outside thing either. It's an inside thing. It isn't just that we want to barrage you with facts and put some history in your heart as if you should know in an external way what all happened. It has to be internalized. And that's why we're so concerned for the young to internalize it by giving their own lives to Christ. It's one thing, you know, to sit and look at a tightrope walker, analyze his task, and think about how easy it would be to do that. That's an outside view. It's another thing to get on that rope and walk across the circus. And that's the inside view. And what's really called for is learning that faith that has been passed on, that God has made real in history, and then internalizing it. Who'll tell the children? That's what we're trying to do. maybe you need to respond to what God has told us in His Word. Would you, as we stand and sing?
Oppressed by every foe that will not tremble on the brink of any earthly woe, that will not murmur or complain beneath the chastening rod, but in the hour of grief or pain will lean upon its God. A faith that shines more bright and clear when tempests rage without, that when in danger knows no fear, in darkness feels no doubt. Lord, give us such a faith as this, and then whatever may